Support for the New Hampshire News Recap comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, inviting the public to On Notice, Inside the 60 Days of Forming a Resident-Owned Community, a virtual presentation on May 8th. More details at communityloanfund.org/onnotice.
It's Morning Edition from NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. The Office of the Child Advocate, or OCA, says it's increasing oversight of the Sununu Youth Services Center following new allegations of abuse and neglect of children in the state's care. Here to tell us more are reporters William Skipworth from the New Hampshire Bulletin and Amanda Gokey with the Boston Globe. Thanks to you both for coming to the studio this morning. How are you?
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Good to have you here. Here to tell, Amanda, I want to start with you. The Child Advocate, Cassandra Sanchez, said that she got a call from a child at the center, and that led members of her office to visit and investigate. What are some of the things that children and professionals who work with them have been reporting?
Yeah, so the state's child advocate, Cassandra Sanchez, said she first learned about these alleged problems at the YDC in early March. She heard complaints about extended lockdown periods that lasted for more than a month. And Sanchez said there were also concerns that children weren't getting to go outside during that time, that their education time was being very severely limited. There was also an allegation that one of the children had been held down in an illegal restraint that actually ended up breaking one of their bones. Some of the children told Sanchez and others from her office that they felt that they were in jail, that they couldn't trust the staff, and that they were feeling depressed from the isolation of the lockdown.
Well, Sanchez laid out a number of concerns about how the facility was operating. What did she identify as major issues with operations that she thinks need to be addressed?
Yeah, I think I'd echo what Amanda said there. So she reported kind of an overly restricted lockdown and that illegal restraint that Amanda talked about where a child's bone was broken.
And can you just explain to us exactly what the role that the Child Advocate plays? It's an independent agency that's supposed to advocate for kids that are in the state's care or get state services. But what kind of enforcement or oversight power does that office actually have?
Yeah, so think of the Child Advocate as the state's kind of youth-focused watchdog. Its job is to oversee different state-run institutions designed for children. So think New Hampshire Hospital, foster care system, that sort of thing. And it gets a level of access to confidential documents and the ability to enter facilities that the rest of us just don't get.
Amanda, there's a history of abuse within the state's juvenile detention system that's, you know, been well reported. Many former residents have come forward with serious allegations of abuse at the center. Can you remind us what the history of that is and how these new allegations play into it?
Yeah, there have really been a staggering number of former residents of the what was formerly called the Youth Development Center, the YDC, often referred to, who just have come forward over the years about alleged physical, sexual, and emotional abuse that they say they endured at this facility. These allegations span several decades. You know, there's complaints dating back to the 1960s, more recently up through 2018. You know, to just put some context on this kind of current abuse allegation, some elected officials have really been invoking this history. And you know, they say the latest allegations should not be seen in isolation. I think, you know, there's a particular sensitivity in the state around what goes on at this facility, just in light of the history. We've sort of all seen the terrible things that can happen if systems aren't in place to stop it.
Well, Will, how are state leaders responding to this latest report? What are they planning to do about it?
Yeah, so the state Senate has created a subcommittee led by Victoria Sullivan to look into the allegations. The attorney general has launched its own parallel investigation. And executive counselors, particularly Karen Liat Hill, the only Democratic counselor, has expressed a huge amount of concern, and they want to be kept in the loop on all this. It remains to be seen what comes of those efforts, but we're hearing a lot of noise, a lot of concern from these elected officials now.
The Child Advocate, Cassandra Sanchez, is in an interesting position here because, as well, she's technically on the job. The governor has made it clear that she wants a new person in the position. Isn't that true?
Yeah, definitely. So back in January, Ayotte's team told Sanchez she wouldn't be not renominating her. Instead, Ayotte nominated Diana Fenton, an attorney with the Department of Education, to replace Sanchez. However, Fenton placed some faced some pretty intense criticisms and accusations of conflict of interest in her personal life, and she ultimately backed out of consideration. So I asked Aon on Wednesday when we can expect a replacement nominee, and she didn't really give me an answer. So in the meantime, Sanchez is operating on holdover status. Sanchez actually told me she's already packed up her office.
Okay. Well, we'll be following your reporting on this. And a note for listeners, NHPR's All Things Considered host Julia Barnett did speak with the child advocate, Cassandra Sanchez, last night on All Things Considered about this report on the facility. And you can find that interview at nhpr.org. A national report estimated that roughly 14,000 to 29,000 Granite Staters could lose Medicaid coverage as a result of the federal One Big Beautiful Bill Act signed last year. Well, we've talked about this somewhat before, I know, but can you tell us more about this report and what could lead to people losing their coverage here in the Granite State?
Yeah, so the report comes from the Urban Institute and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And the crux of the report is that several provisions of the new law will result in Granite Staters losing their Medicaid coverage. Notably, it argues that new work requirements in law that the law imposes will create a massive bureaucracy and a paperwork burden that will just kick some enrollees off Medicaid, even if they're actually working enough to meet the requirements.
And the report does note that there are some things that New Hampshire legislators can do to mitigate the impact. What are some of those?
A couple things. So the work requirement has exceptions for, quote, medical frailty, but it gives states latitude on how it defines medical frailty, how it enforces that exception. So the report argues that, you know, an unclear or a non-expansive definition will kick more people off Medicaid. The law also gives states latitude to decide how many months someone has to work before they can get Medicaid. So a longer time period means more people get kicked off. The report also argues that the way states verify compliance with the work requirement can have a big impact.
You also reported that a community health center in Franconia decided to shut down as a result of the One Big Beautiful Bill. What happened there?
Yeah, so the CEO of Amonoosuc Community Health Services said that they closed down their Franconia branch because so many of their clients use Medicaid to pay for their services, and they just anticipate the impacts of this law being that destructive.
On the other hand, federal lawmakers did make a provision in the law that will send funding to states for rural health care. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, definitely. So when the law was being debated in Congress, that's the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, it got a lot of criticism by people in the rural health world who were worried that it would devastate their industry. As a compromise, lawmakers inserted a provision into law to create the $50 billion Rural Health Transformation Program. So that's designed to disperse funding to states to be used to counteract these anticipated negative effects. New Hampshire expects to receive about $200 million a year through the end of the decade, for example. But a lot of critics are quick to point out that this is a fraction of the money the One Big Beautiful Bill expects to cut from Medicaid.
Okay. We'll be watching for more reporting as this story unfolds. Amanda, I want to turn back to you for a minute. You also have a feature in The Globe this week about the oyster industry in New Hampshire. Now, it has grown, but around New England, oysters have been dying at alarming rates during the winter months, and scientists are trying to figure out why. First, can you tell us what oyster farmers are seeing here?
Yeah, so oyster farmers have been seeing pretty high rates of mortality, and specifically during the winter months. You know, think about bears go into hibernation during the winters, so oysters also enter sort of this period of dormancy where they're not eating. But when farmers start moving them around again in the spring, they've noticed that really high rates of their oysters have died during the winter. You know, on a good year, farmers said they might see anywhere from 25 to 50% mortality. So 50% up to 50% of their oysters have died. And that problem really compounds over time because in New Hampshire waters, oysters have to grow for 3 years typically before they're ready to be consumed.
I know you talked to one farmer here who lost 80% of his oysters. I mean, how can his business survive?
Yeah, that's right. That was just like a very crushing loss. That's what happened to oyster farmer Joe Rankin in 2022. Rankin said it was a really tough loss, but he, you know, had enough money to keep the business going. He had been farming previously in Massachusetts and knew a farmer there who had sort of gone through a similar loss and gone on to have a successful business. So having that sort of background, I think, think gave him the, you know, what it took to persevere and keep going. In the years since, he said he's really come to see that 80% number as an outlier. He said the die-offs haven't been anywhere as bad as that since. It's been closer to, again, that 25 to 50% mm-hmm. mortality rate. But even so, you know, obviously it's a blow to these small businesses every spring, and it makes them harder, makes it much harder for them to grow. You know, we have a short shoreline here in New Hampshire, so there's not a lot of space for new farms to come in. So, you know, if we want to see this industry continue to grow, it will be through farmers being able to keep more of their oysters alive.
Yeah, and I know many oyster farmers around New England have been experiencing these high rates of die-offs, according to reporting. Do researchers know what's happening here?
There's really not a clear scientific explanation at this point. Researchers at the University of New Hampshire are starting to study this phenomenon now. They're trying to better understand what exactly is happening and whether there's anything that farmers can do to make it better and help more oysters survive. You know, the cold alone isn't really an explanation, since oysters are evolved to live in these waters. They're found here naturally. But the winter can be a stressful time, you know, with exposure to pests, things like disease. Researchers are looking into, you know, if storing oysters out of the water actually during the winter might help them to survive better. That's a common practice in Massachusetts, where oysters are often stored in these sort of root cellars or dug pits in the ground.
Dry storage.
Yeah. Exactly correct. Yes. And so, you know, it seems like with that storage method, anecdotally at least, more might be making it through the winter months.
I mean, obviously, this comes at an economic cost, too, which I guess is the fastest growing sector of the state seafood industry. But what are the implications beyond the seafood industry itself? I mean, there are environmental impacts here to this, too.
That's right. So oysters are a kind of cool species that bring a lot of environmental benefits. You know, just one oyster, I learned while reporting this story, can filter about 50 gallons of water a day. They eat these particles in the water, and that leaves it sort of clearer and cleaner. And they can help prevent erosion and provide valuable habitat where other marine species can live. But obviously, if oysters aren't making it through the winter, there's less of those environmental benefits they're able to provide to the region.
Yeah. Just quickly, I want to touch on one more story that we've reported on. Last week, the owner of the Old Dutch Mustard Company in Greenville, New Hampshire, was sentenced to serve 18 months in federal prison for knowingly polluting the Sauhegan River. Amanda, you reported that court documents show the company has a long history of not complying with the Clean Water Act. Just briefly, can you tell us what they're accused of and what happened here?
Yeah, they've had a series of run-ins, this company, with both federal and state environmental officials, really dating back to the 1980s. It's been well documented in the years since, with, you know, both state and federal officials have taken enforcement actions against the company, trying to get them to comply with the law. You know, they required this company to install a monitoring system to make sure that their wastewater was flowing correctly. And then what they've discovered is that the owner, Charles Santich, actually has been accused of trying to evade intentionally evade that monitoring.
Discharging into the Sauhegan, correct?
Yes, directly. That's correct. Yeah.
So what happens to the company now?
Well, the company in this sort of latest action has been ordered to pay a $1.5 million fine, and that's on top of the company's owner being sentenced to actually 18 months in federal prison for these offenses.
Do we know if the company will continue operating?
That, I think, will require more reporting to come up with a clear answer about the future of the company in light of this.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Amanda Gokey, The Boston Globe, and Will Skipworth with the New Hampshire Bulletin. Thanks to you both for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.